between Professors Barnett and Rapoport. And let me, before we begin, let me give you a little bit of background about the subject matter of the debate and also our debaters. I think it's fair to say that originalism is a flourishing theory of constitutional interpretation. There are prominent proponents on the bench and in the Legal Academy, and many of them are here today at this gathering. There's been increased sophistication of intra-originalist debates, such as the one that we're having today. And there's been increased attention, and usually or often criticism, by non-originalists who I think are perceiving originalism as a viable interpretive methodology and who are responding to it as maybe a threat to the dominant non-originalist methodologies out there. But of course, the flourishing of originalism doesn't come without growing pains. There's a debate, a vigorous debate, about what form of originalism is the proper type of originalism: original intent, original meaning, original understanding, original methods, originalism. There's also vigorous debate about what the normative justification is for originalism. We have folks who argue that originalism is the best interpretive methodology to advance and protect individual natural rights. We have others who argue that originalism best leads to the best consequences. Still others argue that it best facilitates popular sovereignty, and others argue that it promotes human flourishing. Today's topic is one of those areas of vigorous debate. Constitutional construction has risen, or the concept has risen to prominence in the last decade. It's been promoted most prominently by Professors Whittington, Barnett, and Solem. And the basic idea is that the Constitution's original meaning, its authoritative meaning, at some point runs out. It becomes underdetermined. And this leaves interpreters with discretion, and it requires interpreters to utilize non-originalist considerations in order to construct the Constitution's meaning in that context. And so there's a lot at stake in this debate over whether or not constitutional construction exists, and if it does, what are its characteristics. On the one hand, for the pro-construction folks, what's at stake is the viability of the new originalism, of the original public meaning originalism. On the other hand, for folks not enamored of constitutional construction, what's at stake is the distinctiveness of originalism as a method distinct from non-originalist methodologies. And I think somebody in the non-construction camp might point to Jack Balkin as one of the problems, so to speak, that arises when construction is invited into originalist interpretation. To debate the existence of constitutional construction, we have two prominent scholars in the area of originalism, Professor Randy Barnett, Professor Mike Rapoport. Both are familiar faces here at the Federal Society. Both are prolific authors and scholars in the area of originalism. And both are articulate and vigorous advocates of their respective positions on constitutional construction. Professor Rapoport will take the anti-construction position. He'll speak first. Professor Barnett will take the pro-construction position. He'll speak second. Each person will speak for approximately 10 minutes, and then we'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. And Professor Barnett won't respond to Professor Rapoport's comments in his initial comments, and instead will save any responses for comments made here for his response. So, Professor Rapoport.
Thank you, Lee. It's a great pleasure here to be having this debate conversation with Randy on these matters. So let's assume for a second, is there feedback here? Let's assume for a second that we're all originalists here. Now imagine that someone came before us and argued that what we ought to do is to interpret the Constitution based on the libertarian theory of justice. Instead of following what the Constitution has written in it, what we ought to do is to follow what libertarianism tells us to do. Alternatively, if you're not a libertarian, then you ought to follow whatever normative theory you regard as legitimate. Now, would an originalist favor such an interpretive methodology? Of course not, right? That's simply not originalism. Now, imagine that instead of interpreting based on a normative theory, someone recommended interpreting based on a normative theory half of the time. Half of the time you'd follow what was written in the Constitution, the other half of the time you would follow the normative theory. Right? Would an originalist favor this interpretive methodology? And again, I think not. Well, if an originalist wouldn't sign on to this latter interpretive methodology, where you follow the normative considerations half the time, then I don't think he would favor following construction either. Because this latter method of following normative considerations half the time is very similar to construction. Right? According to Randy and other constructionists, that's blinking at me. over and over again. So according to Randy and other constructionists, while judges should follow the original meaning of the Constitution, the original meaning is often ambiguous or vague, and therefore it runs out. And when it runs out, the interpreter should resolve ambiguities or vaguenesses based on the normative theory that they regard as legitimate. And thus, construction allows interpreters to enforce, as constitutional law, their normative views a significant portion of the time. Now, I think the main reason why construction is a more popular theory than these interpretive methodologies that I started out with is that some people believe there's really no alternative to construction when the original meaning runs out. I mean, if there's no original meaning, then why not consider normative matters, right? What else is there? Well, today what I want to do is to challenge construction. And I want to argue that its claim that the original meaning runs out and allows for interpreters to base their decisions on extra-constitutional normative matters is really a dramatic and undesirable departure from traditional originalism. I also want to show that going outside the Constitution is not necessary. Instead, I want to argue for a different approach, an approach called original methods originalism that John McGinnis and I have developed in a series of articles over the years, and that this approach operates to resolve ambiguities and vaguenesses. And therefore, it minimizes, possibly even eliminating, the need to go outside the Constitution to resolve these matters. Okay, so we can look at originalism or any interpretive theory from really two different perspectives. And one is an interpretive or a positive perspective, which is to ask, how well does that interpretive methodology actually capture the meaning of the document? And the second perspective is a normative perspective, which basically asks, how desirable is this interpretive methodology? And what I want to do is to explore constructionism and original methods from the perspective of each of these perspectives. Okay, so let me start then with the positive or interpretive perspective on matters. So both traditional originalists and constructionist originalists believe that the original meaning should be followed when the language is clear. But when the language is ambiguous or vague, constructionists believe we ought to go outside the Constitution. Now, the willingness of the constructionists to use normative matters to give content to the Constitution is a departure from traditional originalism, which believe we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't consider normative matters when interpreting the Constitution. In fact, I think going outside the Constitution to decide cases is actually inconsistent with Marbury versus Madison. Right? Marbury was based on the idea that the Constitution is law that the judges are obligated to enforce, right? The Constitution is something that's outside you. You don't have any choice about the matter. You're required to enforce it. Marbury is therefore inconsistent with the idea that judges are allowed to enforce extra-constitutional normative values, right? Values which are neither supreme law of the land nor law of the land at all, actually. Okay, well, if traditional originalism says that we ought not to rely on normative considerations to resolve ambiguities and vaguenesses, then how should we resolve these matters? Right? Well, I think the original methods approach provides an answer. Now, under the original methods approach, one interprets the Constitution by looking to the interpretive rules and methods that the enactors of the Constitution would have employed to discern the meaning of the document. And there's a two-step argument here showing how original methods resolves the ambiguity and vagueness without having to go outside the Constitution, without having to make reference to normative values. So the first step is that the original methods approach argues that the original interpretive rules are essential for discovering the original meaning of the document. One doesn't just look to the original meaning of the words. One doesn't just look to what the grammar rules were at the time of the framing. One also has to look to the original interpretive rules that existed at the time of the framing to understand the document. Because the document was written with these original interpretive rules in mind, applying those rules is going to help to determine the original meaning. The recent case of District of Columbia versus Heller, I think, illustrates this. It's an example of this. So in that case, the question arose as to the meaning of the preamble of the Second Amendment, a preamble which discusses the militia. And writing for a majority of the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia explained that at the time of the framing, there was an interpretive rule that governed preambles. And it said that the effect of the preamble was to resolve ambiguities in the operative provision of the clause. Now, without that rule, Heller might have been decided differently. Without that rule, it might have been very reasonable to say, the preamble is not just limited to resolving ambiguities. The preamble has a greater effect. Thus, not only is Heller really the most important originalist case in a generation, Heller's also premised on original methods originalism. Now here's the second step in the argument for showing how original interpretive rules can resolve ambiguities and vaguenesses. Suppose we've got a provision that's ambiguous, and therefore there's two possible interpretations of it. Now, the original interpretive rules had various methods for resolving these ambiguities. They could consider the purpose of the provision, they could consider the structure of the document, they could consider which word meaning was more common. Most importantly here, the original interpretive rules would provide an answer even when both of the interpretations at issue were plausible ones. So if the evidence supporting interpretation A were just slightly stronger than the evidence supporting interpretation B, even if it's a case of 51-49, the interpreter should choose A. The interpreter should go with the one that has the stronger evidence in favor of it. So in this way, original methods will resolve ambiguities without looking outside the Constitution. According to original methods, really the mistake that constructionists make here is to treat close cases, cases where the issue is a close one, as if those are cases that the Constitution doesn't address at all. Okay. Well, under the original methods approach, there's going to be very few cases where the original meaning is going to run out. Right? It would seem actually to occur only in cases where you have ties, right? Where the evidence is exactly equal between the two different sides. But actually, even in these cases, the original meaning is not going to run out because there's an original interpretive rule that governs these situations. Under a sort of Thayerian type interpretive rule, which was largely followed at the framing, when the evidence is in equipoise between whether a statute is constitutional or a statute is unconstitutional, judges should decide in favor of the constitutionality of the statute. Right? Thus, the original interpretive rules are going to even resolve cases where there's ties. Well, given the time constraints here, let me just briefly conclude by addressing sort of one aspect of the normative question here and leave most of it to maybe the questions. An essential normative feature of originalism is that it's intended to constrain future decision makers. Right? So under originalism, neither the Supreme Court nor the political branches has the authority to change the meaning of the Constitution. And this feature is going to operate to protect rights and limitations that are in the original Constitution, and therefore it's going to limit government. And Randi, actually, in his own work, has emphasized this aspect of originalism, and he's called it by the very useful term lock-in, right? We lock in the meaning of the Constitution, the original meaning of it. But I think Randi's construction methodology here conflicts with, or at least is in tension with, lock-in. Because construction is not controlled by the Constitution. Because construction is not controlled by the Constitution, construction is going to allow different judges using different political theories to change the meaning of constitutional law. Thus, construction is really going to be inconsistent with locking in a single meaning. Original methods, by contrast, I think better allows for a constitution that constrains over time.
Well, as generations of Federal Society chapter presidents will testify, I never agree to debate. I don't like the debate format because I believe it rhetorically commits you to beating the other side or to have the other side beat you. You have to win. And as a former prosecutor, I sort of feel like if I had still wanted to be engaged in that kind of activity, I would have stayed a prosecutor and stayed in the criminal justice system. There's only one time I made an exception for this. About 15 years ago, I think it was, I agreed to debate Carl Bogus, Professor Carl Bogus, on the meaning of the Second Amendment. And I don't exactly know why I made an exception in that case, except maybe it was just way too tempting to debate somebody whose very name was Bogus. I mean, I just think that was just too big a temptation to pass up. So why did I make an exception in this case? I'm still not exactly sure why, except it's probably the opposite reason, and that is I have such a high regard for both the intelligence and reasonableness of my debate opponent here, and also I think really more importantly, we're both working within the same paradigm and trying to work out in good faith the meaning of the paradigm that we both share basic principles in. This is not a situation in which one person's sort of pretending to be inside the tent. We're both inside the same tent, just trying to figure out where that tent really is. And so it's a useful enterprise, and I think it'll be profitable to you, and it's been profitable to me. So let me begin my remarks by defining what I mean by interpretation and what I mean by construction. Both interpretation and construction are activities. Interpretation is the activity of identifying the semantic meaning of a particular use of language in context. Construction concerns the application of that meaning to particular factual circumstances. Now, originalists may disagree about many things, including how we should do interpretation and maybe especially how we should do construction. But we should all agree on the meaningfulness of this distinction, the distinction between interpretation and construction, which is really the topic of this disagreement, this debate. For without it, I believe, we are very likely to be talking past one another and or our critics and confusing ourselves and confusing others. So let me just begin. Let me say that first and foremost, all originalists believe that the semantic meaning of the Constitution is fixed at the time of its enactment. And assuming the Constitution is legitimate, let me just say something about that assumption, which always has to be inserted here. It is an assumption. It is an assumption that's got to be made. And it's an assumption the proof of which, or the convincing of which, is outside the Constitution. So if the Constitution doesn't establish its own legitimacy, there you need an external, exterior theory or notion about what makes the Constitution legitimate, and we could very well disagree about what that theory is while still agreeing that if the Constitution is legitimate, it should be followed by those who are governed by the Constitution, in particular by those members of the government who take an oath to uphold it. The Constitution is the law that governs them and cannot be changed by them without going through the amendment process. Now, where the semantic meaning of the text provides enough information to resolve a particular issue, and notice I'm not saying case and controversy, because this could apply, for example, in the legislative branch, and not necessarily in the judicial branch. I'm just using the word issue here. Where the semantic meaning of the text provides enough information to resolve a particular issue, then in application, it will require little, if any, supplementation, and construction will look indistinguishable in practice from interpretation. The application will look like a straightforward reading off of the text. But however much information is contained in the text of the Constitution, there is not always enough information to resolve a particular issue. Now, to see why this is so, it is crucial to understand how language can be either ambiguous or vague. Consider the example of a light feather, or a feather that is said to be light. The term light can be both ambiguous and vague. A feather could be said to be light in two different senses and therefore ambiguous. Light could refer either to the weight of the feather or to its color or shading. When I say that that feather is light, most likely I mean one of these senses or the other, but I don't usually mean both at the same time. And the context usually reveals which of the two senses I mean. The term arms in the Second Amendment, for example, could be referring to weapons, or it could be referring to the limbs to which our hands are attached. Context reveals it to be referring to weapons. But even where context reveals which sense of light or arms is the intended meaning, there is still a problem of vagueness. Just how heavy must an object be before we cease calling it light and start calling it heavy? How tall must a person be before he is no longer short? Is any weapon included in the meaning of arms in the Second Amendment? Nuclear weapons or weapons in common use by ordinary citizens? What's exactly in and what's exactly out? Now, the problem of ambiguity, I think, must be distinguished from the problem of vagueness, because ambiguity can usually, though not always, be resolved by what Mike and John call interpretive methods. And by John, I mean John McGinnis, Mike's co-author in his piece in the Northwestern Law Review, in which he greatly expands upon the position he just identified here in Mike's presentation. So we might adopt, in interpretation, the procedure of accepting the most probable meaning based on the available evidence, which is what they recommend, and I think which is what we all do. Now, I should note, however, just in passing, that there's a special problem of ambiguity can arise either when evidence of meaning is lost or non-existent, in which case we have an epistemic problem, or when the drafters deliberately injected ambiguity into the text on purpose by using, for example, euphemisms whose public meaning is by definition, because they're a euphemism, something other than what they may have intended to convey. In which case, there may be actually an ontological problem of ambiguity here that was deliberately put in. But with these special cases to one side, I'm not going to deal with those now. Rules of interpretation generally do resolve questions of ambiguity in ascertaining original public meaning. By contrast, vague provisions, vague provisions, the actual wording itself, even when interpreted contextually using all the available rules of interpretation, method of interpretation, simply do not contain the information necessary to decide all matters of application. Vague terms are not wholly indeterminate, they are underdeterminate. Clear or paradigm cases of things that are light or things that are heavy, weapons, things that are weapons, things that are not weapons at all, do exist. But the problem is borderline cases. And when such cases arise, the information conveyed by the language has run out. The information contained by the language has run out. When this happens, we must therefore, in my view, engage in construction and be, you know, somewhat forthright about this. Are restrictions, let's say, for example, are restrictions on sound trucks on a residential street an infringement on the freedom of speech or not? Now, it certainly seems like they could be. They're stopping somebody from speaking on a street. But are they infringing that right or not? How about the requirement of obtaining a parade permit before demonstrating on a public street? Why can't we all run out and now block the road because we're so unhappy about the current Supreme Court without getting a permit first? Is that an infringement on our right of peaceably assembling? Possibly. Sounds like, at first blush, like it's stopping us from doing it. The original meaning of the text, in my view, does not definitively answer these and many other similar questions of application. Instead, we handle these questions by the doctrines, for example, in this free speech area, in assembly, by doctrines governing time, place, and manner regulations of speech, press, and assembly. Now, these doctrines, in my lexicon, are constitutional constructions that are nowhere in the text. You can read that text front to back, up and down, and you're not going to find a doctrine of time, place, and manner regulations in there. But they turn out, I think, to be a very good way to put into effect what the text does say, that the right of freedom of speech should not be infringed. Now, this is not to say that when the information provided by interpretation has run out, all decision rules have run out. We could adopt a decision rule that where a term is vague, it's given its narrow meaning, its narrowest meaning, let's say. Or in constitutional cases, we could say that legislatures have a free choice in borderline cases that cannot be second-guessed or ought not be second-guessed by judges. But these are these rules of decision I would call rules of construction, not rules of interpretation. They are not actually providing meaning to the text. They are saying, what do you do when the meaning has run out? And they are rules that apply when the meaning that is there is insufficient to decide an issue, but that the issue must still somehow be decided. Now, with this background in mind, let me now turn to Mike and John's argument for original methods, originalism in their Northwestern piece. There is much in their most recent defense of this approach with which I find myself in agreement. I believe it was a major step forward in the development of their theory, and I wrote my earlier comment on original methods, originalism prior to them writing their response to my comment. If you read the piece, you'll see they're responding to my earlier comment. So I did not have the benefit of their latest refinement of their position. So let me just emphasize our points of agreement first, because they are not insignificant. First, we agree that the meaning of constitutional language should be ascertained by interpretive methods in existence at the time the language was enacted. That is an important area of agreement. Second, we agree that most cases of ambiguity can and should be resolved this way, by using methods of interpretation. Although I would add, as I did before, the caveat that there may be very special and rare cases of ambiguity, irresolvable ambiguity, that cannot be decided that way. But here's where I think we now disagree. We disagree about the problem of vagueness. We disagree about the problem of what to do with vague language. In their paper, they treat, Mike and John, treat ambiguity and vagueness together as a couplet, and as essentially the same problem. Whereas I believe these are two distinguishable linguistic problems. With vagueness, meaning truly does run out. After all, genuinely interpretive methods are exhausted. Now, I do think, and I want to hasten to add here, that when originalist methodology is properly applied, supposedly vague provisions in the text are often much less vague than they are made out to be by people who want to find more vagueness than is there. And for example, my colleague Nick Rosenkranz's scholarship is a brilliant textualist, not even an originalist actually, but a textualist analysis of how much more information is in the text than is commonly believed. And I, for example, argue that the rights retained by the people means liberty right, natural rights, which mean liberty rights, based on the historic understanding of that phrase. It doesn't mean any right. So even though it may be still somewhat vague as to what a liberty right is and how you protect a liberty right, it doesn't mean any right you may happen to like or think about. That's the original meaning of the text in context. Vague, but not as vague as advertised. But, and here's where I think we may still disagree, residual vagueness remains and is only concealed by the invocation of rules of construction like defer to the legislature in case of vagueness, which are not the same thing, in my view, as rules of interpretation. So, one final comment on methods used at the founding, which is a subject that was dealt with in Mike and John's paper, but not so much in his comments today. Mike and John say there is no evidence of construction at the founding, that where the founders are using the term construction, they seem to admit that they use the term construction a lot. They have lots of examples of which the term construction is used. The founders really meant what we are, all of us, referring to as rules of interpretation, in the sense that they are trying to ascertain the actual meaning of the text and not doing something extra. They're not supplementing. Now, my own view is that sometimes these rules of construction, what the founders refer to as rules of construction, were indeed rules of interpretation and not what this distinction would label them as rules of construction. And it is unsurprising to me, at least, that they sometimes, the founders who use this phrase, sometimes fail to see the difference between which of their rules of construction are really interpretation rules and which of their rules of construction really are, in construction, rules of construction, as it shouldn't be surprising that they may fail to make this distinction. Moderns fail to make that distinction all the time. That's one of the reasons why I've gotten so much mileage out of this distinction, Larry and me and Keith, because it's bringing to attention something that people had really sort of neglected. But we need to remember, I think, and this is important, that when it came to decide constitutional questions, the earliest great constitutional cases, like Chisholm versus Georgia, or Calder versus Bull, or Fletcher versus Peck, or Marbury versus Madison, or McCulloch versus Maryland, in all of these cases, and many, many more, the courts appealed first to the unenumerated first principles that they believed underlie the Constitution, and only secondarily to the text, to affirm or confirm their conclusions reached on the basis of first principles. Nowhere, however, did they ever maintain that first principles could trump the meaning of the text. Never have they said that. But they did think these first principles came first in some methodological sense and could be applied by courts when assessing the constitutionality of acts of the legislature. Now, today, in our post-positivist world, we start with text.
Randy, would you want to?
Two paragraphs. Sorry. Today, we start with text and then recur to unenumerated first principles when the meaning of the text runs out, if not, unfortunately, sooner. But this does not change the basic fact that text is being supplemented by principles when the meaning runs out, and that is not interpretation, but what can be called constitutional construction. If my claim that construction is inevitable is correct, as an empirical matter, then originalists need to debate not only the appropriate approach to constitutional interpretation, but also the appropriate approach to construction. True, we will no more all agree about this than we do about methods of interpretation, but we only fool ourselves and confuse our audience if we try to make more of interpretation than a text will bear by collapsing the distinction between these two necessary legal activities. Thanks.
Okay, well, let me just go over, I'm not sure how long this will last, some of the points that Randy raises, and I'll see how far I get. Okay, so the first basic point, it sounds like much of the disagreement between us is focused in on vagueness rather than ambiguity. And I certainly agree with Randy that vagueness is a harder problem than ambiguity for the reasons that he says. On the other hand, I don't think that when a term might possibly be vague, that means that interpreters can come in with normative theories that are not part of the Constitution and resolve it. Instead, what one does is to look at the Constitution, figure out what the possibilities are, and then pick the one there's the most evidence for. So, to begin with, a lot of terms like the sort of light feather example, not the ambiguous part about it, but what would be light, a lot of, if you actually look at the debates, they take out vague provisions. They say, we don't want to put this in the Constitution. You know, that's going to be difficult to figure out the meaning for, right? So a lot of these things they take out. They're really trying to put things in that have sort of less vague understandings of stuff. But in the end, what's going to happen, when you got a provision, you have to look at the meaning of it. A lot of it has to turn on history, right? You look at how a term was understood previous to the Constitution, previous to it being put in. And a lot of times it's going to be, you know, the evidence is going to be close. There's going to be one will look at the common law rules at the time. And, you know, you're going to have to guess, well, you know, I think the line was drawn here. This would be a judicially manageable line. They were trying to do that as well. You're not going to be satisfied that, oh, you know, you're really confident that you're right. But that's going to be a lot better than simply saying, oh, my political theory says that this is the better answer, right? Sure, that sounds great if we all share the same political theory. But if the guy deciding the provision has a different political theory, one's not going to be so happy about that. Okay, so that's sort of one point. Randy says that certain principles that might resolve these matters are really not interpretation. So he uses the example of deference to the legislature. And if deference to the legislature was a background understanding rule, and we were to use that to resolve a tie, in Randy's view, that's not figuring out the original meaning. And I guess I just disagree with that, right? It seems to me that when we speak against the background of interpretive rules. When we speak, we use word meanings, right? Everyone is totally comfortable with the idea that there are certain word meanings and we're employing them when we speak. And we similarly do so with respect to interpretive rules. And we use different interpretive rules in different contexts. So if we're writing, you know, a medical report that follows certain normal regularities, and the first part of the report that usually does one sort of thing and the second part, we would use those interpretive principles that come from that in understanding it, what it is. And the person writing it would assume that the readers would be using that. Well, if we're in a legal context and there's a legal background interpretive rule that says, look, in cases of ties, the tie goes to the legislature, then they are employing that interpretive rule in conveying their meaning. It's not something that's coming from outside the Constitution. It's not an external value choice. It's as much a part of the communication as the word meanings are. So I think Randy and I disagree on that point. I guess Randy says that when you look at the framers and you look at the interpretive rules, that sure, they don't mention the term construction, but, and even today a lot of people don't use the term construction, but when you figure out sort of what they're doing, it maybe really is construction. And I guess I think we disagree on that matter as well. I think in order to have evidence of construction, one would, you certainly don't need the exact term to be used of construction, but one wants to get a sense from the people at the time that they thought the concept of construction was being employed. One wants to hear them say something like, okay, you know, the meaning runs out. Right, we're allowed to, and what we bring into this is our, you know, what are the correct normative views, right? And some understanding of this notion of construction. And I guess I just don't see that in the framing materials. Maybe there are examples of it, but I don't think anyone sort of brought them to bear yet. If they followed construction interpretive rules, then original methods would incorporate construction. But I just don't see any evidence that they do that. Instead, when they have close cases, when they're thinking about, you know, the arguments on this side are strong, the arguments on this side, you know, this is a difficult case, they don't say, oh, well, we're not sure how to resolve it, we'll just pick the one we like better. They say it's a close case, but we think the evidence is stronger. Right, and that conveys to me an idea of interpretation rather than construction. And I guess I'll just final this last point Randy talked about with respect to first principles. And he mentioned a series of cases where the court seems to talk about first principles. And I'm not, you know, they were a variety of cases. But I'll just talk about Marbury for a second. My understanding of the talk about first principles in Marbury is that what Marshall is doing is trying to give an understanding of what the meaning of the terms Constitution meant and what its normal incidence would be, and that constitutions take priority over statutes, right? So it's... In other words, those principles were built into the terms. When you use the term Constitution, it was understood you meant something that had priority. So I don't think of those references in Marbury or most of those other cases as bringing something external to the Constitution, but instead an explication of the terms in the Constitution.
That's Mike. Well, I think I can make, can everybody hear this? Okay, I think I can make this response somewhat quick, because I think the area of our disagreement has really been made quite clear. The first has to do with vagueness, and whether you actually think vagueness can, a vague term has more information in there or less information in there, whether you think the information provided by a vague term does run out and require supplementation or you do not. Mike thinks it does not, and I think that it does, and I think it's hard to come up with, you know, specific examples that are proof positive, and you're going to have to leave this, you're going to have to make up your own mind about whether you think vague terms actually have a more specific meaning when in application. So for example, this may not even be the best example, it's the one that just popped into my head. Thermal imaging of a house, search, not search. Mike wants us to look at the evidence to decide that. Evidence of what? Evidence that a thermal imaging was included or not included. Is on one side of the line, not on the other side of the line. I don't think that, it's an epistemological question. It's not an epistemological question. It's not something you go back in history and figure out thermal imaging is a search or not a search. They didn't have thermal imaging in their head. So we don't have evidence of what they had in their head, assuming that was even the way you'd want to do it. So that maybe there's something in the meaning of search that really dictates that thermal imaging is in and out and does not require construction. I would like to see as much brought out in the form of interpretation as possible before you ever move to construction. So that's why I'm not sure this is the best example, but at least off the top of my head, it's an example of where, historically at least, you're not going to ask that question the way originalists used to ask that question. So there's a basic disagreement there about the problem of vagueness and how it differs from the problem of ambiguity. When you are actually in the vague penumbra of a word, there is no there that can be uncovered by means of historical evidence. Okay. But now I really think I know what the real disagreement is between, that is a major part of the disagreement between Mike and John and me, but there's another even bigger thing that we disagree about. Notice all that Mike talks about, or principally what Mike talks about with respect to construction, is coming in with your normative theories, importing your normative views about which one can't, we're going to disagree about, okay. Essentially, I think what Mike is really disagreeing about is that method of construction. He doesn't like that method of construction. And that's a debate worth having. That might be an objectionable method of construction for, I would say, extrinsic considerations like rule of law considerations or lock-in considerations or other kinds of... In other words, he might have a normative argument to make against using normative arguments when doing constitutional construction. That's a very reasonable position to have, but it is not a position against all constructions. To reject the opposing view of bringing in normative judges should not be able to bring in normative considerations, to say that's objectionable, is not to refute the necessity of doing construction somehow. Maybe not that way, but by some other way. Like what? Well, for example, you could try to find principles that underlie what the text does say. The text doesn't say those principles, but they underlie those principles. You take those principles, you use those principles in ways that would be more constraining, let's say, than just what Mike attributes to me, this view of just bringing in your normative considerations. By the way, I'm not sure I really want to accept that whole characterization of my view, but I'm willing to do so for purposes of seeing what's really being contested here. So there may be lots of ways of doing construction that look so much more constrained than what Mike is rejecting, that Mike characterizes them as rules of interpretation. But that doesn't make them rules of interpretation. They still may be rules of construction, and they just might be more constraining ones that fit Mike's normative framework. I mean, the last thing I will say about normativity and the fact that we're all going to disagree about what's normative and what's not normative, what's normatively appealing, of course. However, I insist, we're going to disagree about what's normatively appealing about the Constitution and what makes it legitimate. For example, if you think consent is what legitimates the Constitution, we're going to disagree a lot about what constitutes consent, a lot. So there's a lot of disagreement out there. And it's normative in many cases. Sometimes it's descriptive, but most of the time it's normative. And there's no way to do away with normative disagreement. It's going to come in no matter what you do to try to keep it out.
Thank you very much. And so for folks who would like to ask a question,
Please identify yourself, where you're from, and do we have a microphone as well? And get the microphone as well. So, Larry Sala?
Sure. So, great exchange, and if you haven't already looked at Mike and John McGinnis's articles in the Northwestern Law Review that contains many of the ideas that Mike talked about here today, I really would commend it to you. I just have two comments. One is that this interpretation construction distinction is a very old distinction in common law traditions. This is not, there's some tendency, as the distinction has been invoked in constitutional theory, to say something like, well, Keith Whittington came up with this in the 1990s. And that's just not true. If you look at writings on constitutional law, contract law, the law of trusts and wills, at least from the early 19th century, you clearly see a recognition of this fundamental and analytic difference between determining the linguistic meaning or semantic content of a legal text on the one hand, that's one activity, and the activity of translating that linguistic meaning into legal doctrines. So in contracts cases, we got to figure out what the party said, what the linguistic meaning of the contract is, and then we've got to decide what legal effect to give it. Right? In constitutional law, the same distinction is observed at least as early as the 19th century. I haven't done any more historical research than to get me to that point. And the second thing I want to say is that it seems to me that there is a potential and a very important misunderstanding going on here, at least in terms of what my position is, and I think in terms of the general understanding of the interpretation construction distinction and the role of normativity. So the distinction is this: when we're trying to determine linguistic meaning, the work has to be done by linguistic facts. It's not done by normative argument. The meaning of the term legislative power or freedom of speech or Senate or whatever the term is, the meaning of the terms in the Constitution is fixed by linguistic facts at the time of the framing. Normativity comes in construction, not in the way that Mike suggests. It's not that you have to interpret, that you have to import a normative theory in order to do the process of construction. If you're a libertarian, you construe a libertarian way. If you're a social conservative, a social conservative way. That's not the view at all. It's that whatever principles of construction you adopt, you have to give some reason why we should adopt those principles. Now, that's exactly what Michael did. Michael argued that we should adopt original methods in order to get constraint, right? That argument is a normative argument. Now, he had another argument, too, which I think is very interesting.
Larry, can we?
But I will leave that for another exchange.
Mike, do you want to respond?
Yeah.
We only have about 5 minutes. We have to stop at 1:45.
Okay, so let me say two things. First of all, Larry's quite right. His version, I mean, he has a different version of construction than Randy does. And I'm not quite sure, I don't think actually Larry has come out and written up how he would do construction. So what I said only references in part to what Larry was doing. I was focusing on Randy's discussion of construction in his book, which I think is fair to say does reference normative considerations, reflected somewhat in his remarks, and I would just say take a look. I think he says that pretty clearly. So that's for it. There could be other versions of construction that do something different. Different arguments would apply. I would still hold to the view that I actually think these things are covered. They're close cases, but they're still part of the meaning. But that's a separate question. In terms of the Larry also mentions that construction is a very old idea. And I guess I would want to suggest for constructionists, and maybe this is a kind of a friendly suggestion, if one thinks that this is what the framers were doing, an article really needs to be written going through the original materials, showing, here's construction, here's where James Madison is doing it. Here's where Marshall is doing it. See, they don't use the terms, but that's what they're doing. I actually just don't see it. What I see is close questions resolved, as I've suggested. But I would say for really make a convincing case of construction, that kind of work would be useful.
Time for one more. Mayor Alexander.
It sounded to me as if the area of disagreement is extremely narrow. Let me just see if I can hone in. So let's leave ambiguity aside. I agree that's an interpretive matter. In terms of vagueness, in terms of terms that are vague, a lot of vagueness can be eliminated by looking at the authors and their purposes and the like. So within the range in which a term might be vague, we can eliminate a fair amount. Fair portion of that range. That leaves us with the area of ineliminable vagueness, and I would have thought in a case in dealing with the Constitution where there's ineliminable vagueness, one can't say of whatever law is under question that it's unconstitutional, that if it's in that area, one has no warrant for deeming it unconstitutional. Now, that's a default in terms of what the legal system is like. The normative side, I think, comes in a different area, which I would call implementation of meaning, which is the doctrines by which you implement a meaning, which might not be vague at all, might be quite clear, but there's still a step between that meaning and applying it in cases. Mitch Berman has something, even the burden of proof of whether the constitutional rule has been violated requires a construction of an implementation system, and that's going to be normative, and I think it's a particularly interesting question where the norms for that are supposed to come from. But I think that's a different question from the vagueness question, which I think is usually answered in constitutional law by, if you can't say it's unconstitutional, then that ends that question.
This will be the last, I assume, round of questions.
We'll see.
I'm not sure how much I disagree with anything that Larry just said. The principal time in which I use the word, invoke the idea of construction in my book is when I'm debating the presumption of constitutionality versus the presumption of liberty. And then I argued that we choose amongst these constructions for normative reasons. So yes, normativity does enter into in the choice of these constructions. I make that claim. But I do think it's a choice of constructions, and Larry's picked his. I don't think that you can read that construction off the text. And I necessarily think that you can, read it off the historical record either, but that's another matter. So let me just say that. I only invoke normative considerations in a very limited context in my book. But the last, I just want to emphasize what I started with. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I want to talk about the takeaway from this debate. Do not take away from this debate that if you don't like judges doing construction by means of importing their normative theories, which is how Mike characterizes my approach to construction. If you don't like that, that doesn't mean you repudiate or you need repudiate the distinction between interpretation and construction. It means you don't like that theory of construction. And so just keep it clear in your mind what you like and what you don't like, and that there's nothing particularly threatening about distinguishing between interpretation and construction as long as you're willing to defend your views of construction, like Mike is and like I think Larry is. But there is something wrong and threatening if you ignore the difference between these two activities.
Yeah, I guess maybe in the end we just don't agree. Because what Randy just sort of came away with was to sort of take the situations where there's ambiguity or vagueness, or just let's just call it vagueness, and say that, well, that's a construction, and original methods is a version of doing the construction. And I think that's just one, that's Randy's position on it. But there's an alternative view, which basically says people speak against a context of interpretive rules. And sometimes those interpretive rules render their, and the original meanings of the words, render their meaning clear. Sometimes it's close. But just because it's close doesn't mean there's nothing there. This doesn't mean that we're in a non-meaning zone. We're in a difficult question zone. But if the evidence is stronger for one interpretation, then that is the better interpretation, not for construction reasons, but for meaning reasons. And so that would be the alternative take that I have on this matter.
Thank you very much.